The Tom Woods Show, episode 1370.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Of course, I'll be talking about the special counsel's report on alleged Russian collusion, which appears not to have found any. But that's just come out, and I haven't been able to digest it yet, and I'd like to bring a guest on to talk about that. So that'll be coming up. And I realize that there will probably be other podcasts that will cover this, but can you really get enough of this? And we'll try and make sure and put a unique spin on it. A number of my friends have been writing on this subject. There's some good articles that have come out on it already by friends of mine and friends of the show. Dan McCarthy's got a good piece. Tim Carney, I've never had on. I should probably change that at some point. He's got a good piece as well. So we'll definitely have a good discussion of that coming up in the very, very near future. But in the meantime, I have a completely irrelevant episode for you in the sense that it has nothing to, not entirely irrelevant, but has nothing to do with the current events, but nevertheless does have to do with kind of a sticking point for us as libertarians, because a lot of times you'll be arguing something on social media, let's say, and maybe you're talking about taxation as theft or something like that. And what you'll be hit with every time, as if you've never heard it before, this is my favorite part. They portray it as something you've never heard before. They don't even bother to go into any detail. They just tell you, but there's a social contract we all agreed to. And they think, boy, can't believe it was that easy to refute this libertarian. We've actually heard this, and merely asserting that to be true is not actually an argument. An assertion is not an argument. We're going to need, as I sometimes say, we're going to need a little bit more than your ex-cathedra pronouncement, if you don't mind. So that's an argument that we need to be prepared to answer. And I've addressed it on at least one previous episode, but it's a long, long time ago. But I think I've got more and better material now, because one of the things I have decided to do this year, and I can't remember if I said it on the show or if I said it just among friends. But you know what? Look, on the show, am I not in fact among friends, for heaven's sake? But I've decided that this year, I'm going to go back and reread some of the books that I have found most helpful, that I've learned the most from, that I just think in general are the books people ought to be reading about libertarianism. Not the super elementary ones, but ones that really, really left an impression on me, that I learned a lot from, and that I know if I revisit them 15 years later in some cases, that I'm going to get even more from that I didn't get the first time. So one of the books I'm going through, it's not quite as old as some of the others I'm going to be reading, is a book I've had the author on to discuss twice a long time ago. And that's Michael Humer's book, The Problem of Political Authority. And now that's a dull academic title, but he's getting away with murder in this book. So, you know, he probably has to fly under the radar with a title like that. Palgrave Macmillan published it. It's a big publisher. So that's a very, very big deal for him. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado at Boulder. So I'm going through this, and right away, very, very early on in the book, I think, golly, how did I not remember so much of what's in this book? So I'm increasingly inclined to agree with what other Tom Woods Show guest Ben Settle says about business and marketing books, and I'm ready to apply that to all books, particularly libertarian books, which is, instead of reading 100 books, I think it's generally better to get 10 good books and read them each 10 times, basically. You'll retain, and think of how much information you'll retain after that. Whereas if you spread it out too thin, the soil doesn't go down deep enough in your brain to retain all that knowledge. I mean, you'll have knowledge that's a mile wide and an inch deep. But really, you could get knowledge that's a full half a mile wide, but maybe, a fifth of a mile deep, if you do the 10 books 10 times each thing. Now, maybe you don't want to do 10 times, but 5 times. I mean, because as an author of a, even as the author of a book, I've forgotten half the stuff in my own books. I go back and I read a book I wrote 10 years ago. I say, wow, hey, this this thing's good, you know, or I learned stuff from it, because you can't remember everything. So I think this really is a good idea. So that's what I'm doing. So anyway, I got to a chapter on the social contract, and it's got really, really good arguments. I think it really destroys it. And I think we've destroyed it already, but this really, really destroys it. And in case you're wondering, because some of you may not know what I'm talking about, the idea of the social contract, as it's generally portrayed to the public, runs like this. The reason you have to give your consent to the government is that you have consented to a social contract that exists among all of us, between us and the state. And it's true that you may not have expressly agreed to this. So there, you can find a crude, primitive rendition of the social contract theory, according to which there was an explicit contract at some moment in history, and we're just showing our allegiance to that. That's not really how anybody today portrays it. Rather, there are two ways that they try to deal with it, and only one of which will I handle in this episode. The first way is to say that you've implicitly agreed to it by virtue of your action. So by virtue of not moving away, you have implicitly agreed to the rules that are attached to staying. Or let's say by accepting some of the benefits that come from being in the country, then, well, those benefits are supplied to you by the state. You have implicitly accepted the legitimacy of the state. Or you participate in, let's say, elections by voting or something like that, and that thereby demonstrates your consent to the state. Whatever it is, there's some implicitly given consent that justifies the state acting upon you coercively, because you've consented to that arrangement. The second version of the argument that you'd be more likely to hear these days, as opposed to the explicit, there really was a document we all signed kind of thing, is the hypothetical version of the argument, which is that in particular circumstances, you would agree to a social contract. So that's a different one, and maybe we'll get back to that in another episode. I think we have plenty to keep us busy in this one. So Humer starts off by looking at different ways people might, in normal society, be thought of as accepting agreement to something without expressly stating that agreement. So he's going to say it's true that in the ordinary functioning of civil society, there are cases where we don't expressly state agreement to something, but yet nevertheless, everybody understands that we are, in fact, giving our consent to it. Now, of course, then he'll later say none of these apply in the case of the social contract, but he's being a sport here, and he's saying, look, there are cases when we do this. So he says there can be cases that he calls passive consent, where you express agreement to something simply by not opposing it. So he gives this example. He says, let's suppose you're in a board meeting, and the chairman says, next week's meeting will be moved to Tuesday at 10 o'clock. Any objections? And then he waits for possible objections. Nobody says anything. And then he says, all right, good, it's agreed. Well, in this case, really, nobody's going to stand up and say, wait a minute, I never gave my explicit consent to the change of this meeting time. You know, no one is going to say that. Basically, in that kind of situation, it's reasonable to suppose that if you fail to express any dissent, then you do consent to the time change. All right, so he gives that as an example. Then he gives what he calls consent through acceptance of benefits. So maybe you could commit yourself to accepting certain kinds of demands if you voluntarily accept benefits or solicit benefits that those demands are known to be attached to. So for instance, suppose you go to a restaurant and you order some food. And then the waitress brings the check and you say, whoa, whoa, hold on a minute, wait a minute. I never expressly said I was going to pay for any of this. If you wanted payment, you should have told me. But look, I don't owe you anything. But in that case, the restaurant could argue that by ordering the food, you've implicitly indicated that you consent to the normal demand that's connected with providing you with that food, namely that you pay. And because this is just a well-known arrangement in society that the reason restaurants exist is to earn money and get paid, and therefore when you order food, everybody knows you are to pay, that it would be on you to indicate up front that you're breaking with this convention by saying, look, I demand free food. And in that case, they just wouldn't bring you any. But it would be on you to say, I'm breaking with this normal convention. Otherwise, the default assumption would be that you consent to the normal practice. So you would be expected to pay for your meal. Then we have what Humer calls consent through presence. So merely by staying in one place, remaining in a particular location, you indicate agreement to a proposal. Now, of course, as we'll see, and as you well know, that is the one that we hear the most. So when we're dealing with the social contract, we often hear, well, you still live in the United States, so thereby you've thereby consented to being taxed and ordered around and whatever. So we'll get back to that. But the point is, that is the kind of, that's the category he's talking about here. So he gives the example of you're having a party at your house, and then you announce to everyone that anybody who wants to stay at the party after this moment has to agree to help clean up afterwards. So if you then continue partying, well, you imply that you consent to that rule. You agree to help clean up at the end. Now, of course, you'll note that the deal there is that I own the house, so I get to set the rules. Does the state own all the territory, and thereby it gets to set the rules such that you would have to leave if you don't consent to them? Of course, that will be the sticking point. And then finally, we have what Humer calls consent through participation. So if you voluntarily participate in some practice, then you thereby consent to the rules that govern it. So he says, he gives this example. He says, let's say in class, he says to students, he's going to run a voluntary class lottery. And so anybody who wants to participate, put your name in this hat. I'll draw one name out at random, and each of the other participants will then pay $1 to the person whose name is drawn. And then he says, all right, now suppose you put your name into my hat. When the winner's name is drawn, it turns out not to be you. So I come to collect the $1 from you to give to the winning student. And then you turn around and say, I don't owe you anything. I never said I agreed to pay a dollar. I never gave my explicit consent to this. All I did was drop my name into your hat. I mean, maybe I was dropping it in there just because I like putting my name into hats. Well, in this situation, it would seem as if you are obligated to hand over the dollar. Your voluntary participation in that process, when everybody knew what the scheme was and how it was supposed to work, did imply that you agreed to accept the burden if it turns out that you were the loser or a loser. Now Humer is going to go back and look at these four ways in which you can give implicit consent and show how they might apply to the relationship between the individual and the state, and how the individual might be said to have given consent to the state through one of these four means. So passive consent is one of them. He says, maybe citizens typically give their consent to the social contract just by refraining from objecting to it, the same way that at the board meeting, the person says, all right, we're going to move the meeting to Tuesday at 10. Any objections? Nobody says anything. And so we all assume that everyone consents to the change. Well, likewise, maybe that's a good model for looking at how this works when it comes to government. Then what about consent through acceptance of benefits? Well, nearly everybody has accepted at least some benefits from the government. Now, some of these benefits, there's absolutely no way not to accept them. There's no way you can exempt yourself from national defense, so-called national defense. Even pacifists who have moral objections to it, they don't get tax rebates for that portion of their taxes going toward national defense. So that's one thing. But there are some goods that the state provides that, in principle, you could refrain from using. So you could refrain from using the roads. You could refrain from calling the police if somebody is robbing you or something. Or you could refrain from sending your children to the government schools. You could refrain from receiving government welfare benefits. And so in that case, since these are things you could potentially not do, if you do them, well, then it could be taken to mean that you are thereby implicitly accepting the conditions that are known to be attached to these particular benefits, namely that you should help pay the monetary costs of government and obey its laws. So the analogy here would be between with the restaurant where you sit down, you receive the benefits, namely being served the food, so it's accepted that you should pay the money. So likewise, isn't receiving government benefits kind of the same thing? So again, we're going to obviously revisit that. So he's just cataloging the four ways and trying to show how somebody might argue that this justifies government and makes the social contract not a preposterous idea. Then there's this idea of consent through presence. And this is, as he says, and as you and I know from experience, the most popular version of the argument, because it applies to everybody who lives there. Because if you haven't left, the only people who are forced to stay are prisoners. If you haven't left a country, and everybody knows that when you live in a country, there are rules. You got to obey the laws and pay your taxes. If you stay there, maybe you are implicitly accepting an obligation to obey the laws and pay taxes. Then finally, what about participation in the political system? This would be consent through participation, like the lottery in the class where you put your name in the hat, and if you don't win, you have to pay a dollar to the winner. We have something similar in that some people might participate in the political system just by voting. And thereby, it might be inferred that by participating, you accept the political system in which you are participating. And so therefore, you would be obligated to accept the results and live by them and so on. So if any of these four suggestions hold up, says Humer, they would account for both political obligation and political legitimacy, at least with respect to some citizens. Well, now he's going to go through what he refers to as four plausible general principles governing valid agreements. And he's going to show you that the relationship between the individual and the state does not satisfy these general principles governing valid agreements. So he says, number one, valid consent requires a reasonable way of opting out. So all parties to any agreement, he says, must have the option to reject the agreement without sacrificing anything to which they have a right. So he returns us to the boardroom example, and he says, let's suppose instead the chairman says, next week's meeting will be moved to Tuesday at 10 o'clock. Anybody who objects should kindly signal this by cutting off his left arm. Well, this would not be a valid agreement because that demand is, you know, as the price for dissenting, is unreasonable. But it's not even just that that is a really, really extreme thing to demand. It's a question of who has rights over the good that dissenters are asked to give up. And as Humer says, those who seek your agreement to some proposal may not demand that you give up any of your rights, namely, you know, to your arm, as the cost of rejecting their proposal. I may demand that you give up the use of my property if you do not accept some proposal of mine, but I may not demand that you give up the use of your property. Then secondly, explicit dissent trumps alleged implicit consent. So he says a valid implicit agreement does not exist if one explicitly states that one does not agree. So again, suppose, and I kind of gave this example, but suppose you're sitting in that restaurant, and after you sit down, but before the food comes, you say, I'm not going to pay for any food you bring me, but here's what I'd like, you know, an egg salad sandwich. Well, if at that point the waitress brings you the egg salad sandwich, then you would not be obligated to pay for it. You came out and said, look, I'm not going to pay for anything you serve me, but I'd like an egg salad sandwich. So it would be hard to claim that you agreed to pay for that meal because you explicitly indicated your dissent. Now, in the party example, where I announce, look, if you stick around, you got to help clean up afterward. And then after I say that, you just say, I don't agree. So then I tell you, you should leave, but then instead you stay till the end of the party. Are you obligated to clean up? Now, you explicitly said you wouldn't, but you could still be plausibly thought to have to clean up because in that case, it's my private property. And I have the right to set the conditions on which people remain in my house. So this wouldn't have to do with agreement per se. It would have to do with my property right over the house. Now, don't worry. We're going to tie all this together in a minute. We're going through these four ways that an agreement can be said to be valid. And then we're going to go back and apply all this to the arguments for the social contract. So then he gives us a third example. He says, an action can be taken as indicating agreement to some scheme only if one can be assumed to believe that if one did not take that action, the scheme would not be imposed on the person. So imagine at the board meeting, the chairman says, next week's meeting will be moved to Tuesday at 10, and I don't care what any of you have to say about it. The schedule change will happen whether you object to it or not. Now, does anyone want to object? Well, in that case, the fact that nobody speaks up does not indicate consent, because it could just mean, Well, it's pointless to speak up because he already said this is going to happen no matter what we do. So bear that in mind. Now, and the clever ones of you will be thinking in the back of your minds how this would all apply to the social contract argument. Then finally, contractual obligation is mutual and conditional. So normally we think of a contract, we think of an arrangement that puts both parties under an obligation to each other. So you mow my lawn for $10. Well, you have to do the mowing of the lawn and I have to do the paying of the $10. It's mutual. And then likewise, just to use examples we've been using, we might talk about the restaurant. The restaurant is obligated to give you food and I'm obligated to pay. If they don't give me the food, I'm not obligated to pay. And if I don't pay, they're not obligated to give me the food. It's mutual. All right, now let's go back to the social contract. And now let's look at these four requirements. And remember, the first one was there has to be a reasonable way of opting out. So all parties to a contract must have a reasonable way of opting out. Well, what are my available ways of opting out of the social contract? Well, only by leaving. That is the only way I can opt out. Now, why might I not leave? Because that is what's commonly said. Well, if you don't like it, you can just leave. And I think, you know, we have answers to that, but I don't think we stop and appreciate just what's being asked of us here. Because first of all right, in order to leave, I have to have a place to go. And there are plenty of places around the world that have restrictions on immigration, so it might be hard for me to leave for that reason. Then secondly, I may not have the money to leave. So that doesn't mean I'm glad to stay and that I consent to the arrangement. Then what about my family? What about my friends? What about my home? I'm attached to those things. I have to give up my... What kind of insane agreement is this that requires this of me and that people would just casually on Twitter throw this at you as if this is no big deal? And then finally, then I'm going to just be subject to some other government. I mean, what if I don't want to be subject to any of these regimes? What if I don't give my consent? Well, then I either have to live in the ocean or move to Antarctica or commit suicide. And so is this really a reasonable way of opting out? What Humer says is the question is whether being asked to give up something to which I have a right as the price of rejecting the social contract, is that legitimate? In what other aspect of life are we told that in order to indicate your disapproval of it, you have to be willing to leave your family, leave your friends, leave your home, leave the only place you've ever known, and then at your own expense, go find some other place that'll take you? Imagine anyone asking that of you. You would think the person had lost his mind. And yet people say this to you on Twitter all day long without even bothering to stop to think about how antisocial and sociopathic that request is. Now, it could be that the state just owns all the territory and thereby can establish the rules for the territory, including you got to stay and obey or you have to be expelled. But there's very rarely any real demonstration of how the state legitimately comes to acquire title to all that property. I mean, think about the ways that even a social democrat might admit ordinary individuals come to acquire property, right? I mean, we could think about homesteading or through purchase or through bequest or whatever, but obviously the state has not gone along with any of that. So simply to implicitly assert that the state obviously just owns all the territory and then can establish the rules, well, that you're going to have to give us some accounting of that, and they generally don't. And of course, this would have horrible results. It would mean that the state could more or less start dictating what you can do in your home. State owns the property, doesn't it? So the mere fact that the state happens to exercise power over people in a particular place doesn't give the state a property right in all that land. That would need to be demonstrated, and it never is. Now, early in the book, Humer gives the example of you in a stateless society, or I don't remember if it's a stateless society, but it may as well be, in which there are vandals, and you decide you're going to take it upon yourself to go punish those vandals. And then, since everybody benefits from your punishment of those vandals, you're going to extort payment for this service from everybody in your village. So imagine you show up at your neighbor's house, you're going to collect payment for your anti-vandalism services. And your neighbor says, look, I never agreed to this. And then you respond, look, hey, you're living in your house. If you don't want to pay me, you better leave your house. Would we think that was a reasonable demand? I mean, forget, suppose we hadn't been brainwashed and propagandized with social contract theory forever. Would we think that was a reasonable thing to demand? There's no way. No way. Just the fact that the person refuses to leave his house is supposed to be enough to say he's required to pay me. Now, if I had somebody occupying my house, let's say a boarder living in a room, you know, or an Airbnb person or whatever, then I could demand that that person either buy my services or vacate the house. But I don't have the right to demand that my neighbors leave their houses or to say that for them to continue living in their houses, they have to agree to my conditions. So this is not a reasonable way of opting out. And therefore, the social contract violates the first condition on valid contracts, a reasonable way of opting out. Then what about the failure to recognize explicit dissent? Well, there aren't that many people who have explicitly dissented from the social contract, but certainly anarchists have. And yet every government continues to impose taxes and its laws on anarchists, and you can protest all you want. So it thereby violates the rule according to which you have not implicitly accepted a contract if you explicitly state that you do not accept it. Remember, in every other aspect of life, any other area, if you expressly say, I don't accept this, everyone takes that to be the answer. Nobody says, well, now, wait a minute, though, let's go look through his social media and see if in some way he implicitly consented. We would all think that was insane. Then remember the claim that that Humer makes that for an agreement to be valid, that it can be taken, an action that a person takes can be taken as indicating that person's agreement to something, only if that person can be assumed to believe that if he did not take that action, then the scheme would not be imposed on him. And he says this rules out nearly all the ways in which people are said to implicitly accept the social contract. So remember the example here was, we're changing the board meeting to Tuesday at 10, and nothing you say will change my mind. Does anybody want to indicate their dissent? Well, why? What would the point be? That would not be effectual. It wouldn't do anything. Well, in the case of the social contract, we all know that whether or not I use the government's roads, whether or not I vote, whether or not I object to the government is still going to impose its laws and taxes on me. So the fact that I fail to object, or the fact that I accept government services, or the fact that I participate in the political process cannot be taken to imply agreement to the social contract. For the same reason that if I say we're moving the meeting to 10 o'clock and nothing you say in opposition is going to change that, and then nobody says anything in opposition, I can't say, well, see, everybody accepts it. Well, likewise here, everybody knows that if you do any of these things, it's not going to change the state's mind. So the fact that they do them does not indicate anything. Now, there is one form of implicit consent that this principle does not rule out, and that is you do know that if you move away, then the state will leave you alone. That is something you could do that would stop what the state is doing, but we've already ruled that out as legitimate for earlier reasons. And then finally, what about mutual obligation? If we have obligations to the state to obey laws and pay taxes, doesn't the state have obligations toward us? And people would say, yeah, the state, you know, is supposed to enforce your rights and protect you from criminals and from invaders. But what if the state fails in this duty? Like, what if it fails in a way that even it admits showed negligence on its part? Does it suffer any penalties? And presumably, if the social contract means anything, then the state has to have obligations toward the individuals. It has to be mutual, as we said, for a contract to be legitimate. You mow my lawn, I pay you money. You don't mow my lawn, I don't pay you the money. Or if I don't pay you the money, you don't mow my lawn. Well, in this case, Humer uses an example that some libertarians will be familiar with. It's a case, Warren versus District of Columbia. And the quotation from it that's relevant is what we want to make reference to here. And the case basically involved, this goes back to March 1975, and there have been other cases like this since then in which the court reached the same conclusion. A very, very tragic situation. Two men broke into a house in Washington, D.C. Three women lived there. Two women were upstairs at the time. They heard the break-in. They heard their roommate screaming downstairs. So they called the police. They were told, we're coming to help you. So they crawled out of a window and they're sitting on an adjoining roof and they wait. They see a police car drive by and then just leave. Then another officer comes to the front door, knocks, and decides to leave. Doesn't bother to look at the back door, which is, in fact, how people manage to break into the house. So then they go back in the house. They call the police again. They're told, all right, yep, they're coming. And no police car is actually ever dispatched to respond to that call. So then the roommate stops screaming. So the two women upstairs assume that means the police came, the situation has been diffused. So they then call down to their roommate, which, because in fact the police have not come, all that accomplishes is alerting the intruders to their presence upstairs. So the two criminals grab them and basically violate them over the course of the next 14 hours. So they wind up going to court. They sue the District of Columbia in federal court, and they say, this is negligent failure to protect us, clearly. And the thing is, here's the thing. Nobody disputed that the government was negligent. Nobody disputed that these women suffered tremendously as a result. But the court denied the following. The court said the government does not have any duty to provide protection to these three women. And the quotation that has been cited many times, some of you have heard it, is this. The court cited this principle, the fundamental principle that a government and its agents are under no general duty to provide public services, such as police protection, to any particular individual citizen. And so what they say is the government's duty is just a duty to the public at large to provide a general deterrent to crime. So there's no obligation to protect particular individuals. And from this, Humer concludes, there is no contract between the individual and the state. Contracts are not one-sided. They are mutual. And here, at least in the case of the United States and in other places where we've seen the same kind of claim made by the state, there obviously is no agreement. There is no social contract. So what Humer is saying is not that if you ask people, most of them would not agree to have a government. He's saying that there is no valid agreement. He's not saying most people are anarchists. His point is there is no valid agreement. Maybe you would have accepted this agreement if you had the choice to, but you didn't have that choice. And he's not saying that all involuntary relationships or non-voluntary relationships are morally illegitimate. His point is just that the social contract theory is false, because the social contract theory is trying to take a non-voluntary relationship and pretend that it's voluntary, but it clearly is not. And so, in his conclusion, he says the following. No state has provided reasonable means of opting out, means that do not require dissenters to assume large costs that the state has no independent right to impose. All modern states, in refusing to recognize explicit dissent, render their relationships with their citizens non-voluntary. Most accounts of implicit consent fail because nearly all citizens know that the government's laws would be imposed upon them regardless of whether they perform the particular acts by which they allegedly communicate consent. In the case of those governments that deny any obligation to protect individual citizens, as we just saw in that court case, the contract theory fails for the additional reason that if there ever was a social contract, the government has repudiated its central obligation under the contract, thereby releasing its citizens from the obligations they would have had under that contract. Now, if you ask me, that's pretty definitive, right? That pretty much does it. And you're only up to page 35 of this book. Okay, that's how good this book is. That's how devastating and demolishing it is. Now, that's not really a word in that way, but I don't think demolishing is an adjective, but I had to use it because that's what it is. So I'm going to link to this book at tomwoods.com/1370. And I know you're saying, Woods, you are killing me. I mean, some of you may already have had this book on there from years ago when I talked to Michael Humer, but wow. I mean, this is it's got to be in my dozen books. Did I mention it in the episode on books? If I didn't, then shame on me. I meant to. It's just an amazing book. I mean, it leaves these claims in shreds. These claims look even more propagandistic than you thought they were. So definitely check out tomwoods.com/1370. And remember, if these episodes are doing you some good and you appreciate them, then you are really going to enjoy being a member of the Tom Woods Show elite, which you can do over at supportinglisteners.com. It's a great community. And in fact, tomorrow night, a bunch of us are going to do an escape room together in Central Florida. So we do fun things like that together once in a while. And Of course, we have our great private group, and you get many, many nice benefits when you support the show. So please do consider doing that over at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.